This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. Each week, I do a duet with Layla to answer your questions. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll endeavor to answer as many of your questions as we can, providing they are of general interest and of sufficient brevity and suitable for our general audience. So, with that introduction, how are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And I note before we get to our questions, a big story this week. Well, it didn't really make a big splash, but I did see this story in the London Telegraph, and it's a story that I haven't really seen it across the pond. I've seen it reported on in the English papers, and I haven't yet looked at my copy of this month's American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which I think you would agree is a pretty important journal. And we pounce on it when we get it in the office.
You know, we devour it.
We fight over it. It's like, no, let me look at it. No,
wait, let me look at it. No.
Right. So I'll let you look at it after I'm done with it.
Okay, but hurry up.
Exactly. And so in this month's edition, the background on this story is that recently eggs have been exonerated. You know, for so long they were telling us that eggs are poison, eggs are bad for you, that the cholesterol in the eggs will deposit in your arteries, that literally will clog your blood vessels and lead to heart attacks and strokes. And then most recently, in the face of evidence that that was not the case, the Dietary Guidelines for America, the DGA, rescinded its recommendation that Americans restrict cholesterol.
So applause.
Exactly, but that's got to be super confusing for all these people. You know, I think that's why people have completely lost faith in government and establishment dietary recommendations, because we've had so many turnarounds. And by the way, there's a big story this week about how the salt recommendations, the one-size-fits-all salt recommendations, may be wrong. And that, you know, I'll admit that some people need to restrict their salt. There are certain conditions for which excess salt is potentially harmful, but not everyone should be on a very sodium-restricted diet. And there's no evidence that that's helpful. In fact, there's evidence that for some people that may be unhelpful.
Exactly.
Anyway,
here's
the story from the London Telegraph. I guess this isn't just we're not just stopping egg phobia, we're reversing egg phobia, because it turns out that eating 4 eggs a week can reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes by more than a third. Now, type 2 diabetes is probably the major route by which people acquire cardiovascular disease these days. So
people progress 70% faster to coronary artery disease than people without diabetes.
So it's not clear what it is about eggs that lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes. It may be something inherent, some nutrients in eggs that you can't get otherwise,
or it's the fat.
It may be the fat, or it may be the fact that eggs produce some satiety. People then eat less starchy carbohydrates. And usually the very meal where people eat eggs is breakfast time. So if you have eggs for breakfast, like I do, I mean, I just went to the store, and the question was whether to get a half dozen eggs or a dozen eggs, because I was down to 4 eggs in the refrigerator. I thought,
that's an emergency.
Yeah, that is an emergency. I mean, but I said, man, I don't want to carry all this eggs. So let me just get a half dozen eggs, because I'll probably go shopping over the weekend, and I can still get a few more eggs, because I consume about 2, maybe 3 eggs a day.
So I guess
according to the study, I would be in good shape. Okay. Scientists have found that egg consumption was associated with a lower risk of the disease. as well as with lower blood sugar levels. It was found that those who ate 4 eggs per week,
That's better than this.
Just four. Had a 37% lower risk than men who ate only 1 egg per week. And the associations persisted even when factors such as physical activity, body mass index, smoking, and consumption of fruit and vegetables were taken into account. Of course, the researchers warned that those who already have type 2 diabetes should not increase their egg intake. God forbid.
No, they should increase their egg intake because they're upping their protein and fat intake. And to do that first thing in the morning helps them to regulate their blood sugar for most of the day thereafter. Breakfast is the most important meal, not just because we're breaking the fast, but for people with diabetes, it's an opportunity to regulate their blood sugar from the get-go.
So
having an omelet for breakfast or soft-boiled eggs or whatever helps with that.
Just for full clarification, the results here are not all rosy for high-fat diets. I'll point out that eating full-fat dairy products also slashed the risk of type 2 diabetes by 23%. But high-fat meat increased the risk, apparently, of type 2 diabetes in this study.
Okay.
So
I wonder what kind of high-fat meat they use. Did they use bologna or did they use the grass-fed steak?
Well, in England, one of the major sources of high-fat meats is something called bangers. You ever been to England?
Oh, bangers and rashers.
Right.
Oh, definitely.
Exactly. So that's like basically fried potatoes with like these really very fatty sausages, which taste good, but they're probably maybe not the greatest quality.
Yeah, that's true.
So, who's to say that, fatty grass-fed beef
is a processed meat sausage.
So I'm not sure what we can infer from the study that says that meat might be potentially harmful, while high-fat dairy paradoxically prevents diabetes. It appears that, in general, various sources of fat, whether they're from eggs or from dairy, in this particular study, reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. So anyway.
Here's what we know about type 2 diabetes. Out of the 3 macronutrients contained in our food, carbohydrates, protein, and fat, fat is really the only one that doesn't adversely affect blood sugar. It doesn't really disturb it. Carbohydrates do. They send the blood sugar into an uproar and destabilize it. Proteins will bring up the blood sugar slightly, but in a good way. But fats really kind of blunt the whole reaction, which is very helpful in diabetes. And, a typical low-carb, high-fat diabetes diet is 50 to 60% fat, as it should be.
Right.
It helps with blood sugar regulation.
And I think it has to do with a concept called glycemic load, because even if you consume carbohydrates with some fat, it will slow the absorption, and your body will see the sugar in a more gradual fashion, which may attenuate these blood sugar spikes that lead to insulin resistance and prediabetes and eventually diabetes. So I think that that's really what's going on here.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, if you're going to eat a baked potato, put some butter and sour cream on it to lower the glycemic load.
Slather it with grass-fed butter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Good.
Yum.
All right. So let us, without further ado, get to our questions. What's on tap?
Okay, we have a question from, from Nora in Florida. Hi, Layla and Dr. Hoffman. Could you please tell me what a galectin 3 level is? It showed up on my blood work this past year. I don't know what it means. There was a slight increase in my galectin levels from one year to the other. The level was 14 the first year and 16 the next. I look forward to your answer. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, we both did a little research on this. If you want to chime in anytime, let me know. But let me just comment that the fact that you had a blood test and you have no idea what the result means suggests that your interaction with your physician is somewhat deficient, because you're having to call us to interpret a blood test that your doctor ordered, and that ain't good. And, there is this phenomenon now where people are getting ultra-fancy cardiovascular risk factor assessments that include tests that may be of some dubious value. I have to say, we do very extensive assessments. We do tests that include, we'll do what's called a VAPS, which is a breakdown of the LDL into the large and small particles. According to particle size, it determines whether you have good or bad LDL. And then you can even do that with HDL. And you can do that with, you can look at other things like homocysteine, C-reactive protein, LP little a, apolipoprotein A and B. But then there's some other markers that sometimes are thrown into these tests. Now, let me just comment that I recently read an article that shows that several purveyors of these very extensive test panels have been brought up on charges by the government for pushing these panels on patients who don't need them with kickbacks to physicians. Physicians get a kickback when they run these tests. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case here necessarily, or accusing Nora's doctor of wrongdoing. I'm just saying that sometimes these tests are unnecessary. In this case,
laboratories have now joined with the pharmaceutical companies in giving kickbacks to doctors.
That's an old story. I mean, look, frankly, I used to be the beneficiary of, a few things. They'd give us the test tubes that we needed to use. They would, sometimes put a nurse in the office to, draw the blood, defray the salary. Now there's so many strictures that I get nothing. I don't think I get a fountain pen or a rubber band from them. it's just
not a rubber band,
that's a little bit over the top. It's like doctors, can't win under any circumstances. But as to this test, the galectin 3, I actually had to look this up. I thought I knew what it was, and my suspicions were correct. The galectin test is actually a test that should be done really only in patients who have heart failure. It should not be done in patients who are at risk or normal hearts, and they just want, you can do a cholesterol on a normal patient. That's one of the beauties of the cholesterol test. It's like, you don't have to be sick before you get a cholesterol. But it's really only appropriate to do a galectin in a person who's got strain on their heart. It's a measure of strain on the heart. And so, and it's actually sort of a kind of a new quasi-experimental test. And patients who have high galectin levels have a worse prognosis in terms of the risk of death or having to be hospitalized for congestive heart failure. That's what the test tells you. But there's no rationale really for doing that test on a normal person other than to jack up the bill that you send to the insurance company or Medicare unnecessarily, in my opinion. So the level that she describes, I don't think it's a problem. They said there was a slight increase in my galectin level. Well, big deal. Mm-hmm. 14.
It was 14, and then the second year was 16.
Frankly, if you drew one tube of blood and then you drew a second tube of blood and you sent it to the same lab the same day from the same sample, you run it through the machine twice, it could easily be a 14 and a 16, just on the basis of, just slight wobbles in the accuracy of the test. So it doesn't mean that
you're...
But unfortunately, this person now... who's, by the way, in Florida, thanks for listening, Nora, is now apprehensive as a result of this unnecessary test that her heart is in worse shape than it was because this test crept up 2 points. I think this is really an example of A, poor communication, B, unnecessary testing, and, and look at the net result, unnecessary cost and apprehension on the part of the patient.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. We don't know how old Nora is or if she has a heart condition or anything, but we do wish you well, Nora.
Yeah, if Nora has a congestive heart failure and, that is a possibility, then the doctor is monitoring the congestive heart failure, maybe I could see the rationale for this test, and I rescind my comments about unnecessary testing. But I'm not sure, from what it looks like, it doesn't look like this is a panic value of galectin. Mm-hmm. And, certainly our heart failure patients, they benefit from natural therapies. And interesting to see if patients who have high galectins respond well to magnesium and CoQ10 and carnitine and ribose and some of the things that we give to patients who have a weakened heart muscle. That'd be a nice study to do.
Yeah.
Anybody have a few million dollars?
Yeah, heart failure has more to do with an energy-starved heart. But apparently there's more heart failure in recent decades, and that might have to do with the advent of statins, cholesterol-lowering drugs. What do you think?
Yes, I think there is this phenomenon of I think there's probably a little bit of a trend towards reduction in heart attacks. We're preventing heart attacks. But the price that we may pay for that is that patients with weakened hearts because of statins go on to develop congestive heart failure. And for sure, the incidence of congestive heart failure is getting higher. That's partly because we're saving people from dying of heart attacks early. And then as they age, they have weakened hearts, and congestive heart failure is a problem that is not really being addressed adequately.
Magnesium, CoQ10, D-ribose.
Yeah, those are some of the main things. Carnitine, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. So,
thank you for your question, Nora.
Sure. Fish oil, too, I think, for part of
fish oil, most definitely.
Yep.
This next question comes from Frank. What test is required to determine a person's pH?
Well. You want to start with that?
Yeah. Well, you know, people go around testing their urinary pH in an effort to become more alkaline because they think it's healthier, but our blood, our serum pH is very, very tightly controlled by our bodies, especially the kidneys kind of take care of that.
Right.
It's somewhere around, it's slightly more alkaline, around a 7.4 pH is where it resides, and the body will do absolutely anything to maintain that pH. It will break itself down, it will eat itself up to maintain that pH, because any kind of swing in a serum pH would result in death. It's actually that simple.
Yeah.
Now, urine pH is different. You're going to see a range typically between 4.5 to maybe 8, depending on were you eating more acidic foods or more alkaline foods. You know, if you test your urine with a urine pH strip after having a green smoothie in the morning, you're going to be slightly more alkaline for a part of that morning or even into lunchtime for a while until your next meal.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that your blood has gone very alkaline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your blood is not going to ever go that alkaline. It's very, very tightly controlled.
Right.
And, you know, nature gave us acid-forming foods and alkalinizing foods. The acid-forming foods are basically meat. The animals our Stone Age ancestors killed and ate.
But
the alkalinizing is
sugar,
our produce.
Sugar and refined carbohydrates are a major source of acidifying effects in the modern diet.
In the modern diet, exactly.
Cola beverages, too, of course, with phosphoric acid.
The advent of agriculture has introduced grains and dairy, both of which are acidic.
Yeah.
So, and then forget about soda and all that other crap. That's all.
Right.
Forget about it. Yeah.
So this person wants to know, how do you measure it? And
yeah.
I would answer the question slightly differently. Is why should you measure it? Because I really don't put a lot of stock in this concept. I think to some extent it's an effort to get people to eat more plant-based foods, which is fine. So alkalinize your body, and I'm all for that. But I don't think you need to check your pH, either the saliva or the urine or the blood. The blood is very hard, because once you draw the blood out, the pH changes very quickly. So we used to do arterial sticks, which are very painful. And we would find out if someone was acidic, you know, perhaps during a respiratory arrest or something. And in those days, we would actually inject sodium bicarbonate into their bloodstream to try and neutralize the acidity. And it turns out that we did that for years, perhaps decades. It makes absolutely no difference. All it does is turn to chalk in your blood vessels, can probably kills you faster. So efforts to artificially alkalinize people who are acidic don't really help. I think acidity is a condition that develops when you're sick, and you either you don't breathe properly, because breathing, you know, carbon dioxide is one factor that makes you more acidic. And if you breathe shallow, or you don't get adequate breathing, you will become acidic. I think you become acidic when you have poor circulation. If you're sedentary, you don't oxygenate your tissue.
That's right.
I think you become acidic if you eat just pure junk. You don't have any vegetables to alkalinize your body. Your body has to work harder to maintain its alkalinity.
And certain medications, I think, can cause acidity.
No question. Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, when we get up in the morning, we are more acidic, because when we're sleeping, we breathe shallowly.
Yeah. And that, I mean, especially people who have breathing disorders, sleep apnea, things like that. So, you know, it's a complicated thing. And I've actually, I used to expend a lot of time and energy and money, literally, buying equipment to determine, you know, acid alkaline being sold on various systems that would ascertain that. And I have to say that I just put that equipment in the basement. It just doesn't do any good. And I now advocate that people alkalize to a certain extent, but you really can actually get too alkaline, and, and that creates problems too. People who are too acidic, you know, have problems with fatigue and lethargy, and even cardiovascular disease, cancer.
I loved your article in the newsletter last week about confessions of a former vegan.
Right, you. I was too alkaline. I was actually too alkaline.
Yeah.
And if you want it more of the 411 on that concept. That is the concept of, you know, the acid alkaline guy. What's his name? Did you read about it in the article? Now that Kelly. Kelly. Oh,
yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the, you know, the Kelly acid alkaline paradigm dictates that some people are too acidic and some people are too alkaline. Certain medical conditions are alkaline conditions, like allergies, hypersensitivity, and certain conditions are acidic. And, you know, depending on your condition, depending on your individuality, you may need to acidify. I needed in this, I actually needed to acidify. I needed more meat. I needed
you
more
were told to eat meat.
Yeah, I was told to have meat as a therapeutic intervention. And it really helped reduce my allergic susceptibility.
Wow.
No. Anyway.
Wow.
So it's not as easy as it's made out. You know, it's, I think this is one of these, you know, holistic medicine. There's some memes or there's some themes that pervade holistic medicine, which is, oh, you know, you should be make yourself more alkaline. Well, probably a good idea for the vast majority of Americans who are probably too acidic because they eat junk. And they should have more plant-based food. So that's pretty harmless generally. But to turn it into some kind of science where you're checking your pH all the time to see if you can get your pH to a certain level, the science doesn't support that. Mm-hmm. And I'll just point out one other thing, which is let's say you have a medical condition whereby you pee out all your alkaline substances. So your urine is very alkaline, but the net result is you've gotten rid of all your buffering substances in the urine and your body is very acidic. So the urine doesn't necessarily reflect that. Or conversely, let's say your urine is very acid, but you're getting rid of all your acidifying elements and then your body and your bloodstream and your cells remain alkaline. So that's why I've kind of backed away from that concept. And I know that people who listen to this are going to be some chiropractors, are going to be some naturopaths who really adhere to this, and they give their patients litmus paper to test acid. And you know what it is? It's actually like a behavior modification thing. It kind of reinforces the behavior of having a lot of green juices and, you know, smoothies, veggie smoothies.
What do you think of alkaline water, Dr. Hoffman?
I don't think much of it.
Yeah. I thought so,
I mean, you could take some bicarbonate of soda and put it in your water, and that's alkaline too.
Right.
But you'll just get a lot of sodium.
Thank you for your question, Frank. So don't worry about your pH.
Yeah,
just eat well.
Don't
obsess
over it. Yeah, eat well. All right. So this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide these podcasts into two parts. I've had some good questions in part one. What's coming up in part two?
How important is our microbiome?
Oh, the answer is very, and we'll tell you why in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Layla Mutin, this is our weekly Q&A with Layla, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back with part two.